Welcome to Hercules Performance and Physical Therapy Podcast. This week, we have a really special guest in Dr. Brett Hockey at RBI. He's a specialist in regenerative medicine and anesthesiology. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you for taking the time. You're a busy man these days.
Yes, yes.
So, Dr. Brett, give us a little rundown where you started and how you ended up at RBI. What's been going on?
Absolutely. So I have a background as a kid. I loved playing sports, okay? I played basketball. I played baseball. I played college baseball, played a little bit in the low levels of the minor leagues. It didn't work out. And then I went to medical school. And in medical school, I did what's called the Health Profession Scholarship Program. And so that's where the Navy paid for my school. And then as soon as I graduated from medical school, I went active duty in the military. And when I was in the Navy, I spent 2 years out of those eight deployed with the Marine Corps. And as you're probably aware, the Marine Corps is highly, highly athletic just by the nature of what they do. And so between being an athlete as a little kid, being active duty, and then I went into anesthesia. I'm an anesthesiologist. And so I'm looking at what we're doing in conventional medicine, and I'm looking at a lot of the things that we do in the United States. And unfortunately, we wait a lot of times until you have end-stage disease or you're symptomatic before we start to intervene within the medical community. And so that sort of led us to sort of develop RBI. And we started off doing what we call autologous mesenchymal stem cell and combining that with platelet-rich plasma to treat people for joint pain. But what we found out really quickly is that if you were obese and or had insulin resistance or some other type of systemic inflammation, which most of the time people are inflamed for one of those two reasons, that you didn't get any better. So that led us down this whole path of doing preventative medicine and functional medicine, whatever you want to call it, but thinking about disease states before they actually manifest clinically. And so that's sort of the, I would say, the quintessence of what we do right now at RBI, and that is to think about disease states, prevent things before they start to happen, and by in so doing, we'll make you more functional. And when we make you more functional, we're going to increase your chances of living a long life, but also increase your chances of living a healthy life.
So we've talked about this a little bit in some brief conversations on there's this sick care model and there's this healthcare model. And
exactly.
It seems like you guys are on this healthcare model aspect.
Right. I think that it just starts at explaining things, and for doctors, physical therapists, for people in healthcare to be leaders and innovators. And what we have to understand right now in the United States is that there's no economic incentive right now for anybody to think about trying to prevent diseases from happening. There's a lot of people that make money off of morbidity, meaning when you get a disease, there are different entities that make money off of that. But we make no money. There's no industry in the United States. There's no big player in healthcare right now that has an economic incentive to prevent disease. So it's up to us as physicians, as physical therapists, as healthcare providers, nurses, PAs, to start thinking about, okay, how do we do this at a grassroots level? How do we actually teach people? How do we understand disease, first of all, and then teach people what they need to actually do to prevent disease? In so doing, you'll become more functional with the goal of making you better at home, making you better at work, better with your family, improving your relationships, improving your job performance, all of these things that we tend to just kind of neglect with our conventional model.
And that's what we're designed to do, is to go do those things, be functional and interact the way our mental health is. That's us as a person. That's what the medical field should be working on.
Exactly. Yeah. I say it like this. You, Dr. Spanel, are the only person on the planet with your DNA. I'm the only person on the planet with my DNA, and that goes for everybody else on the planet. And so you're a gift. You've been given this life as a gift. And so what we should be doing as healthcare providers is thinking about how do we take that person and optimize that gift? How do we make you whole physically? How do we make you whole mentally? How do we make you whole, help you to become whole spiritually? And that's why RBI exists.
So let's say Sally, she's interested in what RBI has, wants this healthcare type model instead of the sick care. Where would you even start with someone just off the streets, right? Wants to just be better and more functional.
What a great question. And so a lot of times, I would say our wheelhouse is the person who's maybe around 45 or 50 and is starting to notice some changes. Hey, I can't lose the weight. My energy level isn't what it used to. My skin, I'm noticing some skin changes. Mm-hmm. I'm moody, both male and female. That's probably our wheelhouse. I would say it really doesn't matter when you come in. I would say it's probably even better to come in before that happens. But generally speaking, what we do the first time is we would, as if you're coming in, we'd sit you down and we do a whole intake where we address everything from hormonal symptoms to your sleep habits, to your relationships, your stressors in your life, a real detailed documentation of what you're putting into your body, how you're hydrating or lack of hydration, all those things. And then a lot of times, basically what we'll do is an initial panel, okay? And that it's different for everybody, but generally speaking, we're going to look at all of your hormones, okay? We're going to look at, or you see a lot of things like testosterone clinics and these kinds of things going up. Most of the time, I would say these places are not doing it correctly. What we're interested in hormones is optimization and balance. We're not interested in winning. If you're a man, Mr. Olympia, or with a woman, you know, doing something goofy, what we're interested in is optimizing your hormones. So making sure that they're in the youthful, high normal range and making sure that you have balance. So we'll do a hormone panel. We'll integrate that in with your symptoms and your history and your physical examination. Then what we do is something called an insulin resistance score. And this incorporates your fasting insulin, your hemoglobin A1C, your fasting glucose, your triglyceride level, your HDL level, and then something called an alanine aminotransferase, and then something called an C-peptide. So we look at all those things. We calculate a score 0 to 100, 100 being the most insulin resistant, 0 being or 1 being insulin sensitive. And the goal is to, wherever you're at on that spectrum, is to make you as insulin sensitive as you can possibly be, okay? And then the last thing that we do is we do a conventional lipid panel, and then we do what's called a cardio IQ lipid panel. So the number one killer of both men and women in the United States is heart disease. There's a lot of noise about cholesterol and statin drugs, and some people think they should be in the water. Some people think they're horrible. Well, we don't think any of that. We think that if we look at your cardio IQ lipid panel, we look at your conventional lipid panel, we seek to understand atherosclerosis and how it relates to the biochemistry and physiology of your own cholesterol. We look for active markers of plaque buildup, and then we make recommendations based on all those things. So in short, the development of vascular disease, we say atherosclerosis plaque, is as a consequence of, a lot of times you'll hear the doctor call it bad cholesterol. The more appropriate way to say that is what we call an ApoB containing particle. That particle moves into the wall, the bad cholesterol moves into the vascular wall and becomes oxidized. So we seek to lower your bad cholesterol, your ApoB burden, and we seek to lower the amount of inflammation and oxidative damage that you have to try to prevent the development of that vascular disease. So that's broadly, now everybody's a little different, but broadly speaking, that's what we're going to do when we sit you down.
For someone who's walking in and just wants more of a general, I want to be where I want to make sure I stay here long term, right?
That's
that
right.
Preventative type model.
That's right.
So let's say we optimize here. Is it a sliding scale as we get older? Things look different in the panels and we have recommendations for that?
That's a great question. That's a great question. Because then the question, what value is there in the long term, right? That's correct. Such a good question. And the answer to that question is that as you get older, things change. Things can change year to year. And so the way that we describe it is we get that plane flying optimal, and then we keep it optimal as you age. And so that might, it's going to be different things. Some people are going to be predisposed to obesity, okay? Some people are going to be predisposed to having inappropriately low testosterone. Some people are going to be predisposed to insulin resistance, and they may never gain weight. So we're keeping an eye on all those things as we go. And then you're also going to tell us it's 24/7 access to a physician. So you're going to say, man, even though I'm on, we first started off doing, you know, say for instance, a woman, we put her on a little bit of progesterone. She's in her 40s, moody before the first day of her period, a little bit. Even though I'm on that, I'm starting to have this symptom. What do you think about this? Well, we'll come in and we'll evaluate, and then we'll make changes based on the history, the physical examination, and what we're seeing in the labs. The whole goal is to keep that plane flying optimal, and that's what we do.
It's very different than I'm going to go into a doc's office. I'm going to sit there for 5 minutes and walk out kind of thing, right? You're modifying. You're getting feedback. You're taking that all in. I think that's what a lot of people say to me.
I think that what we have to understand in the United States, and I have insurance. I have health insurance myself. I would never tell someone not to do insurance. But what we have to understand is with that model, more and more people are just rushed through. Okay. Yeah. And so the conventional model, we say, hey, I'm depressed. Here's a pill. Or, hey, I've got your bad cholesterol is high. Here's a pill. Now, that may not be the wrong move in the long term, but what we're going to do is we're going to do a deep dive. We're going to sit down with you for an hour, and I'm going to try to understand, like, there's all kinds of nuance that occurs with regard to low density lipoprotein and how that relates to insulin resistance and how the other ApoB containing particles in your blood vessels relate to insulin resistance and whether or not you're a person that is an appropriate for a statin, or you might need another cholesterol lowering medication. And so we're going to sit down with you and do a deep dive. And we may actually, as physicians, we're constantly evaluating things. We're constantly looking at our methods, and we're constantly trying to learn things and get better.
Seems like you can get a lot from just hearing people talk and tell a history, right? And if you take the time, you can start aligning that with the blood panels.
Could not agree with you more. I actually just had a patient who, he's got a history of gout attacks. And there's actually a really good book by a nephrologist by the name of Richard Johnson out of Colorado. And his book's called Nature Wants Us to Be Fat. And he talks about how high fructose corn syrup shunts into this thing called the fructose polyol pathway. The end stage of that is uric acid elevation, which typically will clinically manifest as gout. And what was interesting about this patient is everything that he was telling me that leads to his gout attacks are things that over the long term lead to weight gain and insulin resistance. And so just by listening into him tell me his history, I'm kind of integrating that information into my brain. And I'm like, that's really interesting because it completely agrees with the most recent science regarding this nephrologist in the book that he put out. So
fixing root cause. If you can listen to what people are saying and align it with objective material at the same time, you're always going to get to the answer. They're giving you the answers.
Yes.
Yeah.
They are. People will tell you, and it's just a matter of sitting down, listening, and of course your physical examination is important, and then getting your labs and kind of synthesizing all that, integrating all that with the goal to take what should be a Cadillac, and if it's not, making it a Cadillac, and that's everybody, you know.
Yeah. So in here, we work with a lot of different athletes. We see young, we see older, but they all, at the end of the day, like to move around. A lot of them are gym athletes, on the field, baseball, football, all that good stuff. However, we get a lot of people with joint pain. It's part of sports. You guys do a unique approach over at RBI. Tell me a little bit about stem cell PRP you mentioned earlier.
Absolutely. You hear a lot about both of these things now and out in society. You hear a lot about stem cell. You hear a lot about PRP. So let me talk about what both of those things are and then hopefully shed a little bit of light on what is a good product, what's a quality product, and maybe what's not so good a product. So to start with platelet-rich plasma, your blood vessels, which contain your blood, have in it red cells, white cells, clotting factors, and platelets, and then a lot of other what we call antibodies and different things. But as far as the big things, it's red cells, white cells, platelets, and then clotting factors. Okay, so generally speaking, when you have tissue injury, okay, we've known for 2,000 years that your blood will clot. We know that, okay? With the advent of the electron microscope, what we can now see when you have tissue injury is that when these clotting factors and platelets migrate to the point of injury, they will recruit regenerative cells to help repair the damaged tissue. So what that means in terms of the regenerative space is you can actually pull a sample of blood off of a patient, spin it in a centrifuge in such a way that you remove the red cells and the white cells and you're left with clotting factors and platelets. We call that platelet-rich plasma. And when you inject that into a joint or into an area of inflammation, it has regenerative properties, it has repairing properties, and it tends to improve the joint pain or whatever inflammatory condition that you have. And there's lots of data to support this. So that's what platelet-rich plasma, or PRP, is. Stem cell is, when we say autologous mesenchymal stem cell, what autologous means is it comes from the individual. So autologous stem cell for me would be my own stem cells, for you, your own stem cells. That's what autologous means. You can get stem cells from blood, bone, or fat. Okay. In the United States, the two most common areas are fat and bone. Okay. What a mesenchymal stem cell is, by definition, is that you pull the stem cell out, you pull the sample from the patient, and it has to be able to reproduce via mitotic cell division. Okay. It has to differentiate into either a chondrocyte, an osteocyte, or an adipocyte. So a fat cell, a cartilage cell, or a bone cell. And it has to be able to survive outside of your body for a long period of time. That's the international definition of a stem cell. So if someone says they've got a product that they bought from, you know, whatever, California or whatever, and they shipped it in, and it's a stem cell product, that is not a stem cell, okay? The reason for that is that in the United States, you're not allowed to use stem cell from someone else for common joint pain. Okay. You can do it for like a bone marrow transplant or certain indicated procedures, but not for, you know, for that kind of thing. So I hope that in the future we can get some more clarification on some of the regular, I think it would be easy to regulate. It would be easy to, for people to prove, hey, we have a good, this is our stem cell product. Meaning this is what we're autologous, this is what we're using from the patient, and demonstrate that to whatever governing body. But right now we're not there. So I think important questions to ask are, you know, is this what you're, is it from me, is it an autologous stem cell? And if you're getting it from somewhere else, what is it? It's most likely not a stem cell. It's probably some type of growth factor or something along those lines. And so it's just better to be an educated consumer.
You mentioned we're not there yet. It's not as commonplace. There's certain regulations around it. Do you think the field is headed to more usage of this, and why?
Man, that's a good question. I hope that we're headed to more regenerative therapies like that. I think that if you look at the data, when we first started doing this, we mostly just had retrospective data that seemed to be positive, but that doesn't really establish the science because there's always a placebo possibility with retrospective data. Now what you're seeing, they're smaller studies, but they're randomized controlled trials, meaning they're double blinded, meaning the person doing the treatment doesn't know whether they're giving a placebo or the real thing. And the person receiving the treatment doesn't know if they're getting placebo or the real thing. And you randomize two groups that are seemingly very similar in terms of their background data, their comorbidities, et cetera, and the stem cells starting to show benefit, the autologous. So we're getting more and more randomized controlled trials for both that and PRP. So my hope is that we can go in and, you know, whether it's different states or the federal government or somebody can come in and say, hey, these are the requirements. If you want to have a stem cell clinic, this is what you have to do. This is what you have to demonstrate. Yep. You demonstrate that and, you know, you're good to go.
So we're moving forward in the field. A patient needs stem cells now, PRP. What are the outcomes we're getting from this?
Yeah, I would say that generally speaking, I would say that, and this was consistent with the retrospective data when it first came out, I'd say about 75% of the patients that we treat get some type of improvement. Some people get dramatic improvement. Some people get mild or moderate improvement. But I'd say about, generally speaking, about 75%. Factors that can, where you might not get better. People that are, obesity is definitely something where you're extracting stem cell and then you're injecting in a joint that's highly, highly inflamed and will be highly inflamed until you start reversing that insulin resistance. So obesity, I think that there's definitely a correlation between age. I think the older that you get, the chances of success decrease. And that's all anecdotal. Mm-hmm. I don't have, hard randomized controlled trials to demonstrate that science, but just looking at this from an anecdotal standpoint, I'd say those are the two things that are kind of decreases your chances of success. I do have a significant amount of patients that come from special operations community and, these kinds of entities, and these guys are typically younger guys, are in really good shape, and by and large, those patients tend to have a pretty positive response.
So is it a pain relief quality? Is it the joints moving better? What is this looking like from that standpoint?
I would say to begin with, it's simply just a pain issue. Pain gets better. When pain gets better, the functionality improves, and hey, I can do this and the pain's better. So that's what we're looking for. A lot of people are concerned with the radiographic outcome. And a lot of times we tell patients, like, if you start feeling better and you can move better and you can do what you wanted to do, then whether the x-ray or the MRI improves is irrelevant. We have had some patients that claim, that came back with a post-procedure MRI, a year later or whatever, and said there's improvement. But that, of course, can be subjective as well. It's not necessarily, it doesn't demonstrate that the radiograph's improving. I'm saying it could be subjective with even the radiologist who's reading the, different angles, different depths and all those kinds of things. So there's never, it doesn't establish that this in fact does improve the radiographic examination.
In a perfect world, they would align to make life a lot easier, but sure. It's like you go back to that function at the end of the day. If you're moving better and feeling better, the underlying physiology probably matches it as well.
Yeah.
Anecdotal, right?
Yeah, sure. Sure.
Very cool. So what would you say are the biggest conditions to use stem cells in PRP for?
Number one, without equivocality, osteoarthritis. That's our wheelhouse, osteoarthritis. And unless you're, an Okinawan who's been eating superfoods for the last 90 years, and walking every day, you're going to get osteoarthritis at some point, somewhere in your joints, particularly in the United States, where so much of what we eat and whatnot is toxic. So osteoarthritis would be the number one condition. There are other things, but most of those things are just simply related to inflammation, joint pain, those kinds of things. That would probably be the big one.
Seems like you're, in some of the answers you're giving me, there's always that underlying, we're also looking at the other markers, right? You have pain in your joint, and we're going to address that if it's warranted, but we got to look at insulin resistance and all these other healing factors, because that's how that heals, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I'm a big believer in this. I've looked at this at length. You'll hear my wife and I talk about this until we're blue in the face, but I would say that insulin resistance is related to about 90% of all non-communicable diseases in the United States. And even, the infectious diseases that people get proliferate more robustly in the setting of someone who is insulin resistant versus someone who is not. Insulin resistance obviously leads to diabetes, okay? Insulin resistance is what probably the number one cause of coronary artery disease and what we call atherosclerosis. If you don't believe that, then go to PubMed. There's about 10,000 entries when you type in insulin resistance and cardiovascular disease. And of course, now the big thing is Alzheimer's is actually referred to as type 3 diabetes. And there's a whole physiologic mechanism behind how insulin resistance in the short term leads to depression, anxiety, can exacerbate PTSD, and over the long term ultimately leads to these dementia types of diseases, most notably Alzheimer's.
This is a good point to go. You see all this stuff. We're looking at prevention, especially at RBI.
Right.
What are the health markers? You probably mentioned a few of them already.
Yep.
That are were key for longevity and performance.
Yeah.
Living your best life at 100.
Yeah. What a great question. I would say there's a couple of them. There's a couple of them as far as what we look at. And that's a really, I mean, there's a lot. There's actually a lot. As far as what we look at, I would go back to the insulin resistance score. And I think that the more insulin sensitive we can make your body, the better off you're going to be. The other thing we'll look at is something called an LP little A.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. LP little A is basically an LDL cholesterol particle that's bound to what's called an APO little A via disulfide bond. It's problematic because that molecular moiety, if you will, together abnormally attracts oxidized phospholipids. It abnormally moves into the vascular wall. So it abnormally and exponentially increases your development of vascular disease. And then the other thing is that APO little A is structurally very similar to plasminogen. So it binds to plasminogen receptors, but instead of stimulating tissue plasminogen activator, which is a clot destroyer, it inhibits it. And so it abnormally predisposes to clot formation. So that would be, if you're low in that, I would say that's a marker. That's a good thing. I don't know if it's necessarily a marker for longevity, but getting back to it, I'd say everything that we look at as far as measuring insulin resistance and making sure that your body is as insulin sensitive as possible, to me, that would be the number one thing I think that we're doing to say focus on longevity long term. Now, the big three that I mentioned, metabolic health, so diabetes, vascular disease, and dementia, are all related to insulin resistance. The fourth one that a lot of people think about, cancer, there's not as strong a correlation, but it certainly, when you're insulin resistant, your body provides a nice fertile soil for that cancer to grow versus when you're insulin sensitive, not nearly as much.
Remove as many of the things you can that might be precursors.
Correct. Correct. Yeah, you got it.